Welcome back to UW Medicine Town Hall. I'm Trish Critic, Vice Dean for Faculty Affairs, and I'm really excited to be back with you with Dr. Tim Dellett. He is our Dean and CEO of UW Medicine and our priority guest today. It's been a while since we've done this, and it was great to see how many people reached out with questions. And we're really going to focus today, predominantly, Tim, on the questions that folks asked. I'm going to tell you everybody up front that there is no way I could have gotten all the questions. And so I've tried to lump them and kind of get big themes as much as possible. So, with no further ado, the place where there were probably the most questions was asking about an update on the financial picture for UW Medicine and kind of how, where do we stand and how does that impact what we're budgeting for the coming year? So maybe you could start with
Great. Thanks, Trisha. And again, I won't be brief, as we
that.
talked about. First, I do want to thank Trish for doing this, and I want to thank all of you for joining us here today. These town halls really have a special place, I know, in my heart and Trish's heart, and really our community as we reminisce back through the pandemic. And it was really a wonderful opportunity to come together. And so I really appreciate the opportunity to address some of the questions that our community have. When I think of the finances from a big picture, I think back to almost now 2 years ago when I stepped into the interim leadership role. That fall, we were looking at a $200 million deficit between Harborview and UW Medical Center combined, largely driven by escalating labor costs, inflationary costs, and quite frankly, those expenses just outpaced our ability to generate revenue. I want to acknowledge and thank all of our teams for really tremendous work over the last couple of years to get us into, I think, a much better place. And again, I want to be cautious here because we still have a lot of work to do, but I am really proud of where we are right now. If you look at our performance through April, we are about $400 million above budget. UW Medical Center, and so UW Medical Center, Harborview, all of our entities combined with a net income about $266 million or 5% margin. Now, there are some significant caveats with that. If you take away the one-time FEMA funding, you take away the state appropriation, both of those are one-time and not ongoing, we would be at a negative $35 million through April.
Gotcha.
Now, considering that our budget for this current year was to lose $114 million at UW Medical Center, to lose $63 million at Harborview. And the fact that UW Medical Center is projected, even when you take out FEMA, take out the state appropriation, to be a positive $2.9 million, which essentially is break even, given the overall $1.8 billion budget for UW Medical Center, that is phenomenal progress. And again, not where we ultimately need to be to be able to reinvest into our people, reinvest into our structure and grow strategically, but tremendous improvement. And when you look at the budget for next year, essentially we are looking at a break-even budget, about a 0.1% positive for UW Medical Center, a 2% margin at Harborview and break-even at Valley Medical Center. And again, I think back when you look across the state, 85% of the hospitals are losing money. So this has been a tough time for healthcare in general. And so I'm really proud of where we're at. Ultimately, our goal, though, we need to get to a 3% margin at Harborview, ideally around 2028, ideally around 4% margin for UW Medical Center. That is able to then grow strategically, invest in our people and our infrastructure. Just to give you one more example, and then I'll conclude this. If you look at our capital investment for next year, just at UW Medical Center alone, it's over $130 million. But two-thirds of that is deferred maintenance. Just think of all the water leaks, the water damage that we have had over this past year. We have an aging infrastructure that is behind in its maintenance. And so a lot of our capital investment is just simply catching up on that. Because we have to do that, that really then decreases our available cash. So again, I'm very optimistic about where we are, but I want to be clear, we still have a lot of work to do to get where we ultimately need to be. But again, thank you to our entire community, just a tremendous effort.
I appreciate all of that detail, and I'm going to ask two follow-up questions to that, which I think the take home is way better than it was 2 years ago and still opportunity to keep improving. And The first one is a detail. You mentioned that we are not going to get the FEMA money again, and that was kind of paying us, reimbursing us back for funds during COVID. And I thought maybe you could talk a little bit about the state appropriations and what we received and kind of what your vision is or hope is for the future with that.
Yeah, terrific. And the way I think about this, there was some just plugging the gap in initially. And how did we bridge to get to a sustainable ongoing funding stream? Right. So when you think over the last 3 years for FEMA, we've recovered over $300 million as a system. That is phenomenal. Again, that is covering the cost that we expended in response to the pandemic for our region. If you look at state appropriations for FY 23, 24, and 25, ultimately we had requested $300 million, which is much larger than we've ever received. And we received a total of $210 million. That is a tremendous investment by the state, recognizing our role as a safety net organization, caring for the most vulnerable within our region, and our teaching mission that supports really workforce development for the next generation of scientists and healthcare professionals. We also implemented really unique payment models, in what we refer to as direct payment programs. These essentially make up the difference between Medicaid managed care and about 80% of average commercial. For UWMC and Harborview combined, when you look at inpatient and outpatient, that's $375 million a year ongoing. Those are new funds that, again, are helping us in terms of that sustainability. And then the last thing I'll just say is Mission Forward has been a tremendous success. We have thus far anticipated a benefit over $220 million. But more importantly, what we're seeing are improvements in staffing. We're seeing the number of travelers or agency nursing go from over 20% down to less than 7%. We're seeing reductions in length of stay so we can get more patients into our facilities. We're seeing improvements in the OR with increased surgical volumes. We're seeing revenue cycle improvements. These are sustainable, ongoing things that we need to continue to build upon. And so to me, it's really how do we transition from one-time support, which we desperately needed coming out of the pandemic as a state organization, to sustainable, ongoing funding going forward.
Well, now you've answered my second question, which was, what has been the impact of Mission Forward? But you explained it, and I appreciate that. And I guess part of the thanks you were sharing was for all the people who've done the work as part of Mission Forward. So I really appreciate that. I'm going to shift gears, though. Finances probably will come back up, and I'm paying attention as best I can to the chat and to the Q&A. And I'm feeling a clear lack of Anne here, who usually helps me manage that. And I'm also missing her well-being message at the start. So, Anne, we might have to bring you back next time.
I think so.
Yeah, I'm going to pivot to some of the more specific questions that people asked about. And you kind of alluded to this a little bit, that there's deferred maintenance and there's a plan to build, I think, more operating rooms, but one of the questions that came in was kind of what are our intermediate plans to address the constraints on OR access relative to, clinical demand for surgeries?
Yeah, I think this is a real challenge for us. And I do think of it as what are we doing in the short term? What are we doing in the long term? You know, short term, there are a couple of things. One is bringing on new ORs. So we're undergoing construction at the Montlake Surgical Pavilion to add two additional ORs. At Harborview, we are putting in five new ORs in the 9th and Jefferson building. Those will be for less complex, more outpatient procedures, but they will offload the main OR at Harborview. Long term, really looking at, again, the bond initiative at Harborview, right? As we build that new tower and create additional ORs, we do need to do something with the overall, likely on the Northwest campus. We are doing some renovations, for instance, in the outpatient medical center, largely to support increased procedural space, particularly for digestive health, which will help. And that is also a challenge for us. The other piece that we continue to do work on is really explore opportunities, often in partnership with others around an ambulatory surgical center. I recognize that we are behind where we need to be in terms of having an ASC as we work with our surgical chairs in particular. That's important not only for patient care, but it's also important for training, quite frankly, our residents. And so those are things that we are exploring. One of the pieces, getting back to that capital, because of our investments in deferred maintenance, again, capital is one of our limitations. And so thinking creatively, how could we potentially do this, potentially in partnership with others? But I recognize that is a need that we need to address, and that will help to offload and add additional surgical capacity.
So the just as a follow-up, the kind of two new ORs at Montlake and the Ninth and Jefferson ORs, what's the time frame for those ORs roughly?
Yeah, I think in the next couple of years,
Okay.
they've started construction here on Montlake. They're just starting that at NJB.
Okay.
So it'll take a little bit of time, but again, within that next couple of year time frame, the bond is longer, right?
Yeah.
That is going to be several years out. And again, I do think at some point we need to address the capacity constraints on the overall, Montlake Northwest campuses combined. Now, this isn't surgical, but one thing that will help is that in May, we had the ribbon cutting for our new Center for Behavioral Health and Learning, which I will say is just a wonderful collaboration between the state that funded over $240 million and UW Medicine to really build a brand new facility specifically for the care of patients with behavioral health needs. 50 of those beds are for patients who have concurrent behavioral health and medical or surgical needs. As those beds open up, and we're doing this over a phased process over the next 6 months, that will increase capacity at the Northwest campus. So, for instance, we will be able to open a new oncology floor on the Northwest campus that will give us some inpatient capacity with that shift for the Center for Behavioral Health and Learning. So not OR space, but also meeting a critical need of ours when you think of inpatient capacity.
Yeah, I appreciate that because they're all kind of interconnected
Yep.
and you have to have some place to go if you have your surgery and you're an inpatient. I will say it does feel like town hall to me because I'm getting answers to our questions in the chat. So I
I
got the
love
answer that
it.
I know, me too, that Montlake ORs will open in January of 2025. So thank you for that information. I want to talk a little bit about more about money. There were some questions in the chat about kind of what's the portion of our revenue that's clinical funds, what portion comes as like gifts or donations, and what comes as, grants. And so maybe not, you don't have to give exact numbers, but can you give a sense of kind of the relative contributions and maybe state dollars, in all of that mix?
So if you think at a high level, and I mentioned, UW Medical Center is probably around a $2.8 billion operation, Harborview around $1.6 billion. The school is probably around 2.2 to 2.4, right? So UW Medicine altogether is just over $10 billion. Quite frankly, the majority, if you look at this, is clinical revenue. And in fact, our clinical environment is 50% of the overall university. If you throw in the School of Medicine, we're 70% of the overall university. We continue to do extremely well in terms of grant support. So if you think from a federal standpoint, the university really receives the most federal funding of any public institution in the country, and is really second only to Harvard in overall federal funding. And I believe it's around $1.8 billion in total across the university. Our philanthropy is just over 40% of the overall philanthropy raised by the university. So, in that kind of $350 million, it varies a little bit from year to year, but we do very well from a philanthropic standpoint. The majority of that is support of faculty and research programs. In fact, we are trying to be creative in terms of how do we increase philanthropic dollars to help support clinical operations, which is a little more challenging in terms of a fundraising standpoint. So again, I think we have been very successful there. Research, the reality is research costs money. No matter how much money we get from NIH or other governmental sources, there's a gap. And that is where philanthropy is critical to help offset that cost. And we see those increase of costs, whether it be wages or NIH, essentially is not increasing. In fact, this year, if anything, it decreased. And then you have, again, that wage gap because of the caps with NIH in terms of overall salaries. So The research funding is absolutely critical to us, but we also have to augment it. And the reality for, I would say, every academic health system in this country is that the growth of the clinical enterprise is necessary to help support the education and research activities.
That's a perfect lead into my next two questions. So the first one is, there were several questions that kind of got to this feeling of there's less, a feeling of less support for research. And I heard what you just said right now, but I might translate that into kind of what is the plan to sustain UW as a national or international leader in research? You
Yeah,
know,
and this,
acknowledging what you just said about the challenges.
yeah, no, this focus on the research is critically important to me. And I recognize that when the hospitals are in financial extremis, much of the discussion goes towards that and how do we stabilize the clinical environment. And so it can seem at times that there is not as much attention to the research, but I try to be very intentional around this. I meet on a regular basis with the biomedical research chairs as a group and individually to really think about how can we help support their needs. And I think we've been very successful. If you look at our centers, we have world-leading institutes, right? If you look at the Institute for Protein Design, the Brotman Beatty Institute for Precision Medicine, ICE-CREAM, right, in terms of stem cell and regenerative medicine, IHME, I mean, these are world-leading research institutes, and they are continuing to thrive. We also have the Garvey Institute for Brain Health. These centers are and institutes are doing extremely well. We do have challenges in the research environment. We have challenges with just the increase, for instance, in the postdoc salaries, right? And, as we saw that increase last year, the school actually contributed a third of that gap in working with the departments to try to offset and mitigate that increase because we recognize the impact that has, especially for our early career investigators and our faculty. It is really challenging, right? We also recognize that we need to do more in support of our overall research infrastructure. And I've had a lot of conversations with our provost, who I have to say is doing a fantastic job since joining us in August. She recognizes across the university we need to increase our overall infrastructure. One of the things that has come up recently is animal services. And so there we are committed to freezing prices because we recognize that impact on our research community. So there are things that we are trying to do to address some of these challenges. I would say our big challenges in research, beyond just some of the overall costs of research, particularly here in this market, it's space, right? And we were in an environment where we always had new buildings coming online for, really, over a decade and had that luxury of new space. We don't have that right now. So we are both ensuring that we are utilizing the space that we have and then also trying to think about how do we get additional space? Some of this may need to become through leasing right now in the inability to build our own. But I'll also say we're going to be gearing up for an advancement campaign here over these next few years. This is an opportunity for us to really think about, can we raise significant dollars to support additional resource space? And I actually think we can. One of the areas that we are really focused on right now is in the area of neuroscience. This is just one example. Neuroscience is important because we have pockets of neuroscience activity across our university and across partner organizations. And so we have been working over the last 6 months with our chairs here within the School of Medicine, both our biomedical research chairs that are involved in neuroscience, our clinical chairs, but also deans and chairs from College of Arts and Sciences, the College of Engineering, thinking about how do we come together as a community around support for neuroscience activities. This is important not only for research, but our education for undergraduates and graduate students. We're partnering more with outside organizations. The Allen Institute has been a tremendous partner. We're brought in now Seattle Children's Research Institute. That has always been a partner, but I would say that, our relationship kind of, with any organization has its ups and downs, and really being intentional about being inclusive and working with these external partners and thinking about what can we do together and then working with our donor community. And that's just one example where I think we have tremendous opportunity, but there are a number of other areas where, again, I think we have real opportunities from a research standpoint. So I just want people to hear I'm very, very committed to that. And I also recognize the perception and why that is there.
Yeah, thank you for all of that. I think it's really helpful. I'm going to ask two kind of somewhat granular follow-up questions. One you alluded to, but I just want to ask more specifically. And that is, in the same way that you were talking about deferred maintenance in our clinical spaces, I think there were questions about aging research facilities and spaces. So, do you have any insights into plans to work on those older labs and older spaces?
Yeah, I mean, that is an area that we are trying to do that as well. Now, interestingly, we also are in a period of tremendous leadership transitions. So just in the 2 years that I've been here, we've been in the process of essentially recruiting, six chairs, the majority of which are in biomedical research departments, right? So if you think of early on, bioethics and humanities, global health, genome sciences, now biochemistry, comparative medicine, and we have a new consolidated department as of September 16th with neurobiology and biophysics. And as I go through those conversations with those chair candidates, really thinking about how can we support their needs, some of it is looking at new faculty recruitment, but there's also discussions around updating equipment or facility needs in those conversations as well. We also are investing in, again, our animal care services and the work we need to do there. We recently agreed as we switch over zebrafish, for instance, from biologic structure to comparative medicine, and what is the support from the school of medicine to try to upgrade those facilities over time. So this is something that we are trying to be intentional and really as we work with the chairs to really identify what are those key needs. And again, I do think there's an opportunity for better core resources or shared research services and resources so that we're not having to have duplicate where we don't need it. I mean, I think that's part of it. When you are a scrappy public state university, we can't afford to have duplicate activities going on. We have to really think about how can we do this together. And again, I'm one of our strengths, quite frankly, is the collaboration among our chairs. And again, I have great confidence with our vice deans, with our chairs. We'll continue to make headway in support of the research infrastructure that's necessary.
I appreciate all that. And I'm going to come back. I want to talk about education in a second. But before I leave that, there was a thoughtful question, which I think follows on what you were just asking. And that is, what are we doing to become more of a system rather than independent facilities? And I think that's kind of under the umbrella of UW Medicine, but you're starting to allude to that in terms of just how we function in our research spaces. But just kind of bigger picture, this concept of systemsness and what are we doing to really function as a system?
Yeah, I would say number one priority that I think about on a daily basis is how do we integrate our clinical, our equity, our research, our education, and well-being activities. And note, I've intentionally added equity and well-being. We have to integrate these activities better. There are some things that we're doing, such as just bringing people together. So we now have a council where our vice deans and our clinical leadership come together. Historically, they have been kept separate. But we really need to think about if we're making changes in the clinical environment, what's the impact in our educational programs? What's the impact from a research, particularly clinical research, in that example? Really thinking with our hospitals on the clinic side, how do we better integrate our activities as we think about what services should be on what campus? We're going through an evaluation process with Valley Medical Center now and really thinking about do we renew our strategic alliance agreement as we have to make that decision by the end of this calendar year. A big focus there is really how do we integrate more, particularly a clinical integration in this case with Valley Medical Center? Where are those opportunities, both for improved service to our communities and also efficiencies in the care that we deliver? the research side and the education side, I've been, again, big focus of mine is improving our relationships with the other schools and colleges within the university, improving our relationships with our partner organizations, right? All of these are critical for us to be successful. I mean, the University of Washington is an amazing place, but we're even better when we have really strong collaboration with the environment around us. And we're really fortunate to be where we are within the Puget Sound area.
Yeah, that all resonates with me. I think when I ask the question, like, what are we doing to stay an outstanding leader in research, there was a follow-up question is, what are we doing to sustain UW's reputation in graduate medical training? I'm pretty sure Byron Joyner is out there sending in questions. But I mean, I think we could also say in medical student education or PA education, but like kind of what are the strategies to maintain our reputation as a leader in education and the special things that we do as educators?
Well, when you step back, our educational programs are very unique, right? Again, we are a unique school of medicine with our foundation phase, or those first 18 months across six campuses on five states. We do a lot of work working on those partnerships with in each state, not just the state legislators, but the medical societies, the hospital associations, with the local clinics and healthcare systems that allow training opportunities, and continue to really look for opportunities for clinical clerkships, as an example. We focus a lot on undergraduate medical education, meaning our medical students, but we do have to increase graduate medical education across the Whammy region as well. Again, our whole goal, if you think about it from a workforce development, is to train locally, develop community engagement so that our students, once they're finished with their training, are more likely to practice in those rural underserved areas across the Northwest. If we have graduate medical education programs there, that makes them even more likely to stay. And so that is an area that, again, we, with our partners in each of the states, have to continue to increase those. We have a wonderful family medicine residency network that has over 30 partners now. The University of Washington leads that, and we provide certain services, but it is a real collaborative, and we're exploring, should we set up networks for other areas? It's been raised with pediatrics. It's been raised with internal medicine. Are there opportunities as we think about graduate medical education across our Whammy region to do that? So again, that is something, it's part of who we are for the last 50 plus years. And I think, again, opportunities as we go forward in the future of Whammy.
I think, you and I have talked about how Whammy is particularly unique and powerful. And at the same time, one of the things that makes us unique is we also have like subspecialty training in like, very niche areas of surgery or, high-end medicine and oncology. So is the goal to maintain both of those, or do you feel like there's a shift in kind of where our priorities are in terms of education?
No, I think the goal is to both, from my standpoint. And I think, again, that's what makes us unique. I trained on the East Coast, where it was very heavily specialized.
As did I.
But I think what's unique about our School of Medicine, we have, in my mind, the best family medicine training, the best primary care rural medicine training that used to be evident in the rankings, which we no longer participate in. So I just say, I believe that we still are the best in those areas. But we also have world-class complex care. If
Yeah.
you look at the innovation in our highly specialized care, and again, some of this is in partnerships. It's in oncology with our Fred Hutch partnerships. It's partnerships with Seattle Children's or the VA. But being able to have both of those really sets us apart. And that training opportunity for our students to train in the most remote areas of Alaska and then come on the trauma service at Harborview, where else are you going to find that type of a training opportunity?
I think the answer is nowhere. All right. Okay, relevant to that, in order to have all this outstanding teaching, we need outstanding faculty. And there were a number of questions that came up, I'm pretty sure from faculty, about trying to get our faculty salaries in line with peer institutions. And so curious what your thoughts are on this topic, which you and I have discussed many times.
Yeah, I mean, this continues to be a priority for us. Now, we're trying to attack this on a few different fronts. One is through our clinical department funding. So when you look at the agreements between the hospitals and our clinical departments to think about how do we fund that clinical activity, last year we started a 3-year journey to incorporate both compensation and productivity benchmarks. Our goal is to get every department up to the 50th percentile MGMA in terms of what we refer to as their PSA rate, or how many dollars per work RVU they get. That is an important step so that then the departments have the adequate funds to help support compensation for their faculty. Now, within the university, we have limited ways we can increase compensation, right? And that is one of our challenges. We are trying to bring on new faculty at the 50th percentile. That does create compression with some of our faculty who have been here a while. We try to address that through unit adjustments. But the other ways this can be done, unfortunately, are things like retention, which we don't want to lose anyone. So I hate to get it to that point. Promotion, which is excellent, but really, for most faculty
It
occurs
happens a
maybe
few times.
twice, right? And even with the unit adjustments, the last two unit adjustments, we invested $15 million and $10 million. And we still are struggling to make progress because everyone around the country is continuing to move at an accelerated pace as well. So this is something that, again, we continue to discuss, particularly with Central Campus. I will say, when I think of recruitment and retention, I want to talk about this because I think this is one of our risks, and it has been identified as a top risk for the university as a whole. And I think of the financial, where we've got to be market competitive. We may not be the market leaders, that's going to be tough, but we've got to be market competitive. But it's also the non-monetary elements that are absolutely critical, right? It's like, what are we doing to improve our learning and work environment so that everyone feels welcome and can thrive, right? That's where our equity, diversity, inclusion work, our well-being work is absolutely critical to create that environment for individuals. What can we do to decrease their barriers to allow them to do what they want to do? I fully recognize, I'm just going to go to the elephant, housing and childcare. These are two really challenging issues from a recruitment and retention standpoint. And again, this is where the provost and I have raised these to one of the highest priorities for the university, which is important from a resource standpoint to really think about options as we go forward. We also have two work groups, specifically one on housing, one on childcare, and you're a participant in one of those. And they are going to be giving me recommendations here over the next month or two. And really, I've asked them to be innovative, think out of the box, non-traditionally, and really think about what could we potentially do as a school or system ourselves, what may need to be done with the university as a whole, and what may not be feasible. But we need all of those ideas on the table. So this is an area that is absolutely critical to us. And again, I think if we can do the non-monetary pieces, it augments what we're trying to do in the compensation categories, just recognizing the market dynamics.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I think all those things are super important. And I will just give you an update that Dr. Walker Harding and I will give you a report before the end of the month, which was our deadline. So don't you worry, and hopefully there'll be things that we can share forward with the greater community as we move forward. It's been an outstanding working group, and we look forward to sharing our recommendations with you.
Yeah, no pressure.
Exactly. Thanks for putting that into town hall. I think I also would be remiss right now to say Anne Browning, if she were here, would say, please, everybody, fill out your well-being survey, because it's that information that helps guide the initiatives that we do to try to improve the spaces and places where we work and the environments in which we work. Speaking of challenges in our workspaces, I'm going to change gears a tiny bit. And one of the things that came up in multiple questions was the challenge of workday. The transformation to workday. And I think it came up in the realm of the burden on our administrative teams. It came up in the realm of research and the myriad of impact on our research teams. And I think kind of the way I synthesize that is kind of what do you think are the implications of the challenges that we've had with workday, and kind of How are we moving forward from all of this? Because it's been really hard on just life, but also like people's science and their ability to advance what their kind of work is.
Yeah, and I want to start by just one acknowledging how difficult this has been, and quite frankly, on behalf of the university, apologizing because I think there are anytime you have a big initiative like this, right? Think back to our Epic rollout. It is anticipated there are going to be bumps, especially in those first several months. For us in particular, it was really in grants and contracting. How do we pay our vendors? How do we deal with subcontractors, particularly international subcontractors? And I fully appreciate how difficult this has been for our teams and, quite frankly, for our partners. And to some degree, the reputation of the university as we work with those partners when we haven't figured out how we can pay them. And I think we really struggled for a long time since that launch last July.
Yep.
I am more optimistic now, in part because I really appreciate Sarah Norris Hall, who really leads the finances for the overall university, Jason Campbell, vice president, who works on Sarah's team. The two of them, what I appreciate about them, they have acknowledged the issues. They have recognized what is not working and that we need to shift our approach. And they, I think, and their teams are really digging into this, and we've seen progress. We're not where we need to be, but we are definitely seeing progress and reductions in some of those work queues and the challenges that we've had. So I think, one, I just again really thank the people who have been especially directly impacted. Obviously our faculty, our staff, but it's really the finance teams and our administrative staff that have really borne the brunt of this. And again, they deserve our grace because they have been put in an extremely difficult position. There are going to be a lot of lessons learned when we debrief from this, but I am optimistic with the teams now that are leading these efforts that we are making progress. But I fully acknowledge it's been too slow.
Yeah, I appreciate that because I think it has and continues to be a struggle for folks. You were commenting on the staff kind of bearing the brunt of a lot of this. There was a follow-up question about, I asked the question about equity and faculty salaries, and curious your thoughts about the priorities around staff salaries and what we're doing in terms of staff salaries to make sure they're competitive or equitable.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the same approach. I mean, I know we were talking about faculty earlier, but we want all of our, whether it be our staff, our faculty, or our trainees. Now, some of this is going to come up through collective bargaining, right? We've just gone through collective bargaining with our ASE group, our student employee groups, our graduate students. We're going to be entering into labor negotiations again with a number of our unions come this fall and early next year, as well as with our residents and fellows. And again, our goal is we want to be able to reach agreement on fair and equitable compensation. Again, we often, as negotiations start, may start in a different perspective, but our goal is really to come together and reach agreement. Through those negotiations, the collective bargaining units have really seen significant increases. And again, wanting to be competitive, particularly within our local market area. With professional staff, we also are trying to be competitive and really look at what is the market doing, and then working with our compensation and HR teams to either make adjustments where we can, or certainly as we hire new individuals so that we're competitive. So again, I just want to be clear, we are cognizant of the impact across all of our people.
Thank you.
And again, each one requires a different strategy. I do think if you look at our recruitment retention, particularly in the nursing side, we're seeing that impact with our ability to hire more people right now and that reduction in travelers.
And hold on to them.
That is so important for, I mean, the finances, yes, but the most important to me is the having cohesive teams that impacts the quality of care, the continuity of care, it impacts patient safety. That is absolutely critical. And so I'm really pleased to see our staffing much improved because that plays a role for everything else we do.
Yeah, I appreciate all of that. I'm going to shift gears again. Another thing that came in actually today, as well as through the questions, was around primary care. And actually, I'm going to focus it on our employees being able to get their care in UW Medicine. And I'm a patient in our system, and I think there were a number of questions about can we make it easier for us to get our care here? I will add, people in general want to make it easier for patients to get their care here, but maybe you could reflect on both of those.
Yeah, access is a real challenge. It's not unique to UW Medicine. I think all healthcare systems, to some degree, are challenged for access, not just in primary care, but even sometimes worse in specialty care. For our employees, there is a dedicated appointment line. Now, not all of our employees actually know that there is a dedicated appointment line, but there is to try to prioritize. Both our employees and their family members to getting appointments. Last fall, we also rolled out our virtual primary care and urgent care that, again, allows same-day appointments through a telemedicine platform, which, again, telemedicine has been very good coming out of the pandemic. As I've said this before, we went from, 200 visits a month before to over 30,000 those first few months, but we're still doing 20, 25,000 visits a month. And in fact, over 20% of our primary care visits are telemedicine. And so that virtual clinic has been really successful to allow that immediate access as well when it's appropriate. Like, not everything is appropriate for telemedicine, but that has been a benefit. But we still have work to do. Part of this is, again, as we think about really what is our ambulatory network strategy, right? In terms of how do we really think about our overall access and the lives that we're serving, and in particular with our employees as well.
Appreciate all of that. I'm going to try to fit in a couple more questions, and then I want to shift gears for two last things. We got multiple questions from medical students, and I think that the theme of the questions are kind of what are we doing to support our students? And some of it was around exactly what we're talking about, which is really healthcare for our students, and that we don't offer student health insurance plan for our students, and that makes it particularly challenging when we're trying to center our students in the ways that you've talked about. I think the other thing that came up was that for a state school, we have a relatively high tuition. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about strategies to support the challenges in terms of healthcare and cost for our particularly right now talking about medical students.
Yeah, no, those are really important questions. On the healthcare side, I want to just take one step back because often it's a question of, why don't we have insurance for our students? That really is not a school of medicine decision alone. It's really a university approach. Several years ago, prior to the Affordable Care Act, the university did provide the option of healthcare insurance for our students. With the Affordable Care Act that was discontinued, thinking that access to coverage would be more readily available through the exchange programs, and it was required as an initial part of the Affordable Care Act, where it is not now. So those are discussions that we ongoing have across the university in terms of what that need is. But to date, it's not offered across the university. Where that particularly causes challenges for our students is that we, as I mentioned, are across five states. And so, particularly for our students in their third and fourth year on clinical rotations, how do they continue to access healthcare if they're in another state? If they, for instance, have Apple Health, which, as an example, would cover emergency care, but is not going to cover as much for routine care. This is not a perfect answer right now. There are some things that we have tried to do. So, for instance, we do allow our students 2 days without question that they can take off during each of their rotations. And we encourage them to get the care, particularly for chronic medical conditions, at their home base. And we've tried to add in days that they can use in a flexible way for them. There are Again, telemedicine is not perfect, but there are telemedicine options, including through Hall Health, where individuals have been licensed in all five states to be able to provide that access to care as well. But we recognize it is a challenge. And so I think it requires our students to be intentional around some of their planning of when they seek their routine or chronic condition healthcare when they're in their local state. I will say the cost of medical education is a real challenge, again, across the board.
Yep.
Our tuition, we typically increase it by about 3%, which really is doesn't even cover the increase in costs for the school. What I have been focusing on is really, okay, how can we offset that, particularly through scholarships or financial support for our students? Now, we do have, through the last campaign, we did a really good job with our endowed scholarships. We have about $140 million in endowed scholarships. That seems like a lot, but when you have 1,100 students, even though we provide over 200 scholarships a year, it doesn't cover everyone. And so this is going to be one of our goals as we continue into this next advancement campaign, is to continue to build both the endowed scholarships and current use, right? So that we can use it immediately to support students. The other thing that we've tried to do since I've come into office here, we now provide AMBOSS and UWorld. These are two programs that really help with preparation for step one and step two that are not cheap. And my concern before was those students who could afford to get them had them. And if you couldn't afford it, then you unfortunately may not have been able to use those resources. And we wanted to make sure that all of our students had access to that. So I'm also trying to work with our academic affairs team to really think about how else can we support our students through scholarship, through support of like these preparatory programs. What are other ways that we can help support our students, recognizing that impact of the cost of medical education?
Appreciate all of that. Okay. I told you I had two last little things that we're going to do. There's no like ask an ID doc, but that
Good.
people forgot. Well, you are an ID doc, but people forgot, didn't forget that this is COVID town hall in the past. So there were two COVID themes as holdovers from previous town hall spirit. The first one was series of people who asked how important it is to keep getting COVID boosters. And I'll just note that I also got the vibe from many people that they're noticing that there's a lot more COVID all of a sudden again. So, how important is
Yeah,
it to get a booster?
very. Yeah, so I do think it's really important that people continue to get the boosters when they're eligible, particularly, again, individuals, based on age or immunocompromised, the most vulnerable, really need to do that. But I think it's important for all of us. I'm curious to see how this evolves, right? So we got the booster last fall. I fully anticipate there will be another booster this fall. Those who were more senior were able to get additional booster this past spring. I think it's actually really important. As you said, we are seeing some increase in COVID activity. Now, it's not at that threshold level yet, but we all know of people who have been impacted. And anecdotally, it seems like people who have not been boosted seem to have more severe infection, at least the few people that I know. Again, overall, we are in a much better place than when we first saw COVID with very little immune protection and no vaccine. But I really encourage people, especially our healthcare workers, not only to protect yourself and your families, but the patients and your coworkers. And so while it's not required, I strongly encourage you to get the booster when it is available.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I'll just, disclose to everybody that after 4+ years, I finally got COVID and it was mild, which I was deeply grateful for. And I think it is because I was boosted every single time they gave me an option to get boosted. So I appreciate that message. I also appreciate that you answered my follow-up question, which was, are we requiring it? And the answer was no, it's not required, but strongly encouraged. Okay, in the last like less than 10 minutes, there was like one super philosophical question that somebody sent in that I felt like I'm going to actually take not exactly verbatim, but the spirit of it. So they asked if you could have done one thing differently during the last year, what would that have been? And then the follow-up is how does that impact the coming year?
Yeah, I think Yeah, I am not one that tries to dwell too much on the past. I mean, I do every day. Trust me, there are things that I think about where could I have stated something better? Could I have been more clear? There are always opportunities for us. There is not a magic one decision that, oh my gosh, that led to this outcome that I wish was different. But I will say, going back to one of the earlier questions, our capacity issue. One of, I think, I don't know if it's a regret, but it's a realization that these are difficult things to move forward, is that, you know, we've had a lot of discussion around various options to try to increase capacity. A lot of discussions around, you know, what do we do around East Side planning or ASC planning? And without going to the specifics, I think, you know, we haven't made the progress I would like to see in really moving some of these initiatives forward. It's not the fault of any of our team. They are doing phenomenal work, but it is the circumstances and the healthcare market in which we find ourselves that these are just really challenging. But I think, you know, again, as we build that muscle, we have a great strategic officer now with Elizabeth Fleming, and as she builds her team and really understanding our market dynamics and her partnership with other partners in the region, really thinking about where those opportunities are and moving forward. I think one of the things that we sometimes have been challenged with as a system is making, doing our analysis and making decisions in a timely manner. And that is something that we need to do in a more expedited manner if we're going to be able to compete. And so I think those are the things that, when I think, just look at the environment around us, right? There's the potential agreement between MultiCare and Overlake, and what does that mean for us or different parts of our the UW Medicine organizations? That, to me, you know, tells us we need to be more nimble in terms of how we analyze those opportunities, how we make decisions, and how we invest in those activities. So I recognize the capacity constraints that everyone feels, and I think that's the one area that I would have loved to have seen more progress moving forward. But again, I'm optimistic that we have the team in place that can move these forward now. Keep in mind, we've had a lot of changes. I mean, I've been in this role, I think, since December, although, you know, as an interim almost now, 2 years. We've got a new president of hospitals and clinics. Elizabeth is relatively new in her chief strategy officer role. And so a lot of transitions within our organization, but I'm really excited about the potential in the future. This year, though, is going to be a critical year to get some of these initiatives moving forward in a more concrete manner.
Well, that ties into my last question for you, which came up from many people. And that is, if you were going to give some of the priorities for the coming year, what's kind of top on the list?
I think continuing the financial sustainability and shifting from the one-time to more sustained funding. An example of this, you know, we, through the last legislative session, were able to work with colleagues to get essentially a legislation passed or modified that allows a county to levy a tax in support of its county hospital. Well, there's only one county hospital, that's Harborview. And so really thinking about how that could be in partnership with the county, thinking about how do we best support not just the capital needs of Harborview, but the operation and maintenance needs, right? And how do we do that in a sustainable way? How do we think about this from a UW Medical Center, and where are there opportunities for sustainable funding going forward? So that's one big bucket. Partnerships is also critical. Partnerships with other healthcare systems, partnerships with other research organizations. Again, building upon that is absolutely critical as we go forward. You know, and then there are specific areas within the research area, right? I talked about the neuroscience, and really I want to see that come to fruition over this next year. The team has done a tremendous amount of work in that space. You know, our educational programs, we start with, you know, 275 students are going to be joining us here in just a couple of weeks in mid-July. And I want our student programs to be successful so that as our next graduating class, you know, that they have successful match and go through that graduation period. So I have a lot of personal goals across all of these areas that I want us to really be successful. And again, I hope I'm able to convey, it's just like your children, all aspects of UW Medicine are important. They are all absolutely critical to our overall success, right? And so that is one of the fun things about my job, is having that window across all of our activities and really being able to help us support our teams in each of these areas so that we can be the outstanding organization, again, in all five of these areas, right? Clinical, education, research, but the well-being and equity are actually paramount and foundational threads that have to underline those other three.
I appreciate that. And I think it came through in all the answers to the questions you gave today. I suspect that others listening felt that as well. I want to make one comment. You and I were talking before we started about your purple tie, which I noticed. One of the people who was listening said, we should be wearing more purple. We should paint this place purple. And I'm feeling particularly remiss that I did not wear my purple jacket today. And I promise the next time there is a town hall, I will do so. So, Tim, I want to say thank you so much for answering these questions. I want to say really deep sense of gratitude for all the people who took the time to send in questions and who came and attended today. I know there'll be many more people listening afterwards, but really the engagement in our community is really inspirational to me because people want to keep making it better and take care of each other. So thank you to you. Thank you to all the folks who joined today. And thanks for everybody who helped support us having a town hall. It's been a while. I think that the response today suggests that it's good to do this on a periodic basis. So our plan will be for another town hall in the fall so we can talk about the kind of start of the year. Thanks to you. Thanks to everyone. Take care of each other and keep taking. I can't remember what I say at the end of the day. What do I say? Continue to take
Take
care of
care
our
of each
patients,
other.
their families, and take care of each other. Oh my gosh, I'm out of practice. Bye, everyone. Great to see you.
Right. Thank you, everyone.